And good afternoon, everyone. We're talking fish today. The fishing industry has sustained this part of the world for generations. It's shaped everything from our culture and language to our architecture, where our communities are located, which towns grew while others remain small. While the fishing is one of our most successful industries, it's faced some serious challenges in recent years. With changing demographics caused in large part by the cod moratorium a generation ago, one of the greatest challenges involves recruiting younger people into the industry. Fishing for Success aims to change that. Kimberly Oram co-founded the social enterprise a few years ago, and she joins me now on the phone. Hello, Kimberly.
Hello, Linda. How are you today?
Great. How are things in beautiful Petty Harbor?
It is actually beautiful Petty Harbor today. It's bright and sunny, and we don't have a gale of wind right now, so it's a wonderful day.
And it is such a beautiful community. I mean, perfectly situated. And this is exactly what we were talking about right off the top here. I mean, Petty Harbor exists because of the fishery. It's in that deep valley, two big cliffs on either side, and that nice little protected harbor.
Just beautiful. Yes. And one of the things that a lot of people aren't familiar with is that Petty Harbor also has a historic protected fishing area. It's about 3 miles out, 3 miles wide in Motion Bay, where fishing families have, since about 1895, protected cod fishing by hook and line only. So even during the commercial fishery, you can only fish for northern cod by hook and line. So it's a little known fact. It is part of the Canada Fisheries Act, and it's one of the reasons, of course, that drew the little nonprofit Fishing for Success here to Petty Harbor, because it's a wonderful story to communicate to young people, if you want to teach them to fish, that fishing can still be done sustainably in today's modern technology, when people are still today fishing by hook and line.
That's fascinating. I had no idea that Petty Harbor had that history of protecting a sustainable fishery.
It's cool, isn't it? And very few people are aware of it. But as I said, it's in the Canada's Fishery Act, and there you go. And very few people know about it, and yet it's just, 15 minutes from downtown St. John's. So very happy to share that with everybody today. And if anybody wants to email fishing@islandrooms.org, I'd be happy to share a document or a link to the document that tells you about the history of it and how that has played out over the years and why that was supported by the fishing families here, and interesting history about it.
So why is that? Does that exist in Petty Harbor, and does it exist anywhere else in the province?
Not that way. Fogo Island has, of course, a limited hook and line fishery that they started so that they could promote a sustainable hook and line fishery, and they have Fogo Island fish, which of course many of us have probably seen the hand line fish movie short film that promotes that. Traditionally in Newfoundland and Labrador, and in fact around the world, the hook and line way of fishing is one of the earliest ways to fish. And but it's been maintained here in Petty Harbor, as I said, on the books since about 1895, when it was part of the British Fisheries Act. And then, of course, when Newfoundland and Labrador became part of Canada in 1949, then the fishing families here worked to make it part of the Canada Fisheries Act. And so that took some time to do, of course. And so I think it was in the early 1960s, by order of council, when that was made officially part of the Canada Fisheries Act.
So do Petty Harbor fishing families today still participate in that hook and line fishery in that area?
Yes. So commercial fishermen who want to fish on the traditional fishing grounds have to use hook and line only. If they want to use gill nets, they have to go out beyond the traditional fishing grounds and drop gill nets there. But so most of the fishermen who fish within those, well, they have to. If they're going to fish in the traditional fishing grounds, they have to fish by hook and line only. So, yes. Yeah. And so it's a little known fact, and there you are. So if you buy fish from local fishermen in Petty Harbor, you can ask them, do you fish within the traditional fishing grounds in the protected fishing area? And then you should be getting hook and line fish, which is really exciting because that kind of fish, they're caught one at a time and handled one at a time and killed quickly. And it's a sustainable way of fishing because you roll up your gear and take it home at night. So there's nothing left in the water to entangle marine mammals or to get lost and contribute to microplastic waste. There's very little damage, if any, that's going to be done to the bottom. So the fish habitat remains there. So the fish are happy to come back because all of the habitat that they depend on, or their furniture, so to speak, is still there. So they come back every year. It's a great way to fish.
Why did we move away from hook and line?
Oh, technology. newer, bigger, brighter, shinier. And it reduces effort to use gill nets or to use draggers or trawlers. And so you reduce effort. You can catch more fish faster. But the problem is it damages habitat, which, when you damage habitat, the fish may not come back. So you reduce fish population. The other thing that the fishing families in Petty Harbor were concerned about, of course, is that you are reducing effort, which means that you're reducing employment. So that becomes a problem and contributes. That is a social problem. But the biggest concern, of course, today is, or one of the biggest concerns, especially by organizations like Fishing for Success and many of our partner organizations, that leaving gear in the water overnight and using damaging gear like that does over time destroy habitat and again contribute to the plastic pollution in the ocean.
So the change, the move away from hook and line then obviously were for economic reasons. Can we participate in a economically viable fishery that involves hook and line?
Well, I'm gonna debate a little bit about the economic reasons thing, because you probably have been following in the news about all of these grants and efforts recently to go back and retrieve fishing waste in the ocean. So that's been a huge impact on, it's what's called ghost gear, where this fishing gear gets lost in the ocean because we've left it overnight or we've left it for a few hours unattended, and a storm came up or something happened and the gear breaks loose and we can't find it. And so now this gear is literally fishing forever, catching and killing indiscriminately animals in the ocean, and we can't go back and retrieve it. And then it begins to break apart over time, and plastic really doesn't break down. It just breaks apart into smaller and smaller pieces, so it's always there. So it does a lot of damage, and so now we're trying to retrieve it, and that's costing money. It also cost us by killing more animals than we're not eating them. So it's cost us in many ways. And so we haven't figured in that cost to the economics of fishing. So I don't know that I would argue that these bigger, faster ways of fishing have been economically better, because they've cost us in other ways that we haven't quite gotten the total numbers on yet.
My guest today on Target is Kimberly Orange. She's one of the co-founders of Fishing for Success, based out of Petty Harbor. And I was going to ask you more about what is Fishing for Success, but
you got off a tangent.
Fascinated me with the whole hook and line and the history there in Petty Harbor. We're going to get back to the basics, I guess, if you will, in our next segment right after this. And my guest today is a very enthusiastic Kimberly Orange. She's one of the co-founders of Fishing for Success. And usually my first question is pretty straightforward. What is Fishing for Success?
Well, Fishing for Success is a nonprofit social enterprise. And as you found out, of course, already, we're located in Petty Harbor. And we established to teach children how to fish. And it sounds like it's pretty basic. And to come to Newfoundland and Labrador and teach about fishing seems like
counterintuitive, maybe,
okay. Counterintuitive, but But, you know, since growing up in Newfoundland and Labrador, so many of us don't fish anymore. It's almost, well, it is. We have a lost generation since the cod moratorium of 1992. We have a whole generation of young people who have grown up without an easy access to fishing, especially out on the ocean. And we don't all have that nan and pop anymore who work in the commercial cod fishery and can take us out fishing on the weekends or whatever that might be. And so passing on that heritage is extremely important, not just defining who we might be, but also connecting us to nature and connecting us to where our food came from and understanding this bigger, broader connection to the ocean and why it's so important that we talk about our part in understanding why we should work towards the ocean and where it fits into climate change and microplastics and ocean warming and acidification and all of this huge, big stuff that we can't get our heads around. But yet the ocean is right at the center of climate change, and it's driven by climate change, and it drives climate change. And so, you know, getting out on the ocean and just kind of, you know, getting out there and becoming personal with it, I think will really help all of us to see that, oh, yeah, we are connected to this space and it does mean something to us. And then, you know, reconnecting to food, because fish is a valuable protein for so many people around the world. And when we think about, there's going to be 9 billion with a B people around the world, and many of us are dependent upon fish as that protein. And so what does it look like to provide food for that many people? And so the ocean is at the center of all of this.
So, it's fascinating. As you're talking, I'm realizing myself, I'm 2, if not 3 generations removed from the fishing industry as a whole. Mm-hmm. Now, I did have some great uncles who participated in the fishery, and some people in my husband's family still do fish from time to time. But my son is so far removed from that lifestyle and what it means and how it all works that I don't know if there's a way to teach him about it.
Exactly. And so we think that it's just, we just take it for granted. We go about our daily lives and we live in our homes and we go into a car and we go to work that's in another box. And so we go from a box to a box to a box and we never get outside. And unfortunately, COVID has multiplied that. We're even, you know, we don't get outside anymore and connect with nature and what it means for us to really have these meaningful discussions about correcting some of these issues about our impact on the natural world and what it really does mean to us living inside our boxes and connecting to one another on social media like we do. It's a real challenge. But what we're finding is that you know, mental illness has become a real sore point right now. I think Dr. Hagee mentioned that the online resources have been tapped into, you know, 400 times more often than they had pre-pandemic. You know, we're literally losing touch with our basic selves, and a lot of that is because we are, you know, in these boxes. And humans didn't evolve that way. We evolved in this close, intimate relationship with nature. And we are we need to get outside, whether that's outside fishing or out just outside walking around your neighborhood, feel the sunlight, feel a little bit of breeze on your face. All of it's connected. And so nature is a huge, valuable piece of our mental health.
Mike Wall, who hosts the Health and Wellness Show, calls it Vitamin N.
And vitamin
it,
nature.
And it wasn't until he used that term that it hit me, you know, how mm-hmm. much better I feel when I'm connected in some way to the land or the ocean.
Yes, Richard Louv wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods. He talked about nature deficit disorder. and about how our children are spending more time on screens than they are in nature. And it's producing, a lot of stress, anxiety disorders in our children. It's producing a lot of physical health issues in our children. And we have a real, crisis on our hands with that. Children spend less time outdoors than prisoners do. It was a human rights crisis when prisoners in the UK were not getting their hour a day outdoors. But yet, I would venture to say that children in Canada don't get an hour outside every day. So what do we do? How do we do that? How do we reconnect children with nature?
It always struck me that looking back now on conversations I've had with older people in particular, is that the people who always seem to have a real handle on what is actually going on are the farmers and the fish harvesters. You just have to ask them, you say, wow, it's been a really hot summer. And, that's your perception of things. And they'll say, well, actually, no, it's been a little bit cooler. And I'll tell you why. The crops were much later this year, or the fish didn't come in like they usually do. So there's something, they have a much better understanding of the cycle, the whole system, I suppose, of the environment.
Yes. Yeah, the seasons and the cycles of nature and the ebb and flow of the water. And yeah, it's just beautiful. It really is meaningful. And so that's it. I mean, as a former high school science teacher who was, I would take my high school students out for field trips. And I just noticed over the years that the children had less and less knowledge of the plants and animals in their own backyards. And I was just worried that I was teaching the wrong thing, that, the basic thing that excited me about science, getting outside and looking under rocks and fishing and waiting to see what I pulled up next. These kids weren't, exploring that anymore. And they were glued to their screens. And I was just worried for, literally the future of science and the challenges that face us as a human species,
It struck
so here
me.
We are.
Yeah, indeed. It struck me not too long ago that I was scrolling through social media, as we are all wont to do these days, and I noticed that somebody had posted a picture of a stinging nettle and said, "What is this?" And it struck me as strange that an adult would be taking a picture of a stinging nettle, posting it on Facebook, and asking the general populace what it was, when most of youngsters at a very early age know exactly what a stinging nettle is very early on.
Right. Yeah.
So there is that disconnect.
More common.
Yeah.
That's more common today than not. And and there you are. So getting just the very basic thing of getting people outside, helping people to reconnect with their natural heritage, with their local heritage, all of that helps to reconnect people with this place, with their ancestors. So it's all of those feel-good kinds of things, too. And then you can start moving up through the chain of encouraging young people to become scientists, to become meteorologists, marine architects, maybe even to go into commercial fisheries or, to become involved in the food fishery. So there's so many broad things that you can go with from here. Being on Twitter, as a lot of people are, I noticed a tweet by a astronaut who said that they first became interested in science through fishing. So you just don't know, what that little hook is going to be for someone. But we do know that by just looking at the history of fish and fishing, that fish and fishing has inspired us throughout human history to create some really wonderful things. Like, take George Street, for example, when we could walk down George Street and listen to the music that would spill out onto the streets. It was music about fishing and being out on the sea and being on the ocean. And walking the rooms is amazing artwork that's inspired by the sea. Literature you know, Hemingway, for example. So all of these things about, you know, our challenges that the sea has brought has inspired people to do amazing things. And so we're leaving people out by not exposing them to it.
My guest today on Target is Kathy Orange. She's with Fishing for Success in Petty Harbor. And when we come back from the break, I want to ask you, Kimberly, about some of the challenges to recruiting young people into the fishing industry or fishing as a whole. We'll be back right after this. And my guest today is Kimberly Orange. She's one of the co-founders of Fishing for Success. And before the break, I sort of teed up the fact that we're going to ask you a little bit about what some of the challenges are to recruiting young people into the fishing industry or fishing as a whole.
That's a tough thing. So if we're talking about commercial fishery, it's a huge investment. A young fish harvester on the Northern Peninsula once said that it was easier to become an astronaut than it was to become a fish harvester.
I believe it. I believe every word of it because it seems so daunting, doesn't it? You have to own an enterprise. There are health and safety concerns, training, navigation, whatever capital you might have to invest, insurance. The list goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is tough. You've got at least a 5-year investment before you can be eligible to purchase a fishing license or enterprise. And so you've got to take your Marine Institute courses, and you know you've got to pass Transport Canada exams. You've got to get sea time and log that and have a certain amount of sea time. You've got to have a certain percentage of your income during the fishing season come from fishing alone. Now, when it's not the fishing season, of course, you can work at whatever job you can get. The challenge, of course, is that most employers don't want to hire someone, you know, for just the non-fishing season and then have you leave again when fishing starts up. So that's, of course, the challenge. Of course, once you work your way through the levels, having, you know, gotten your courses, passed your Transport Canada exams, gotten your sea time, met the income requirements, and then met all your, you know, the criteria through the Professional Fish Harvester Certification Board and done all of that, then you've got to have some money to purchase an enterprise. And sometimes the cost of the enterprises, of course, not sometimes, but the cost of the enterprises is a huge investment. You know, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars most of the times. So when young people see that, so that's why the average age of fish harvesters today is almost 60. So you can see that we're looking at a real problem. So if we're talking about issues regarding food security or one that's closer to my heart, which is food sovereignty, which is the discussion around not just being able to buy food or have food personally, which is food security. I like to talk about food sovereignty, which is control of local food, getting young people to be able to become professional fish harvesters is about food sovereignty. So we need to develop a succession plan for young people. And we don't have one right now.
What's caused this generational gap, so to speak? We know that cod moratorium obviously played a role there. However, there has been a movement, and a lot of people applaud it, of course, that it started, I would imagine, back in the late 70s. It certainly started ramping up big time in the 80s and started to become more formalized in the 90s and onwards, is towards professionalization of the fishery. Because one time, you know, a church minister could go out fishing. Teachers were going out fishing. Everybody was going out fishing and sort of, you know, catching what they could catch for the benefit of their families or whatever the case may be, or to make a few dollars on the side. There was a movement towards professionalization of the fishery where more of these type of operations were enterprises. Is it mm-hmm. harder then to, because there used to be an apprenticeship program and everything, not program, mm-hmm. but it was a natural progression towards apprenticeship where somebody would join their family's fishing enterprise and off they would go. But there seems to be less right. and less of that type of thing now. Is it because of some of those barriers, so to speak? Are those barriers at all?
I mean, I feel that they're barriers, but I also land in the middle somewhere. I feel that also because of we're talking about the most dangerous profession in the world, quote unquote, and it is. And so I feel that the professionalization is needed, but I also think that there should be some kind of stepping nature. So, for example, if we're talking about fishing inshore in a small boat to handline fish for cod, and that's the kind of fishing that you want to participate in and purchase that kind of license, perhaps, do we need to go through the whole entire training to be certified to handle a 65-foot boat offshore? You know, maybe we need to look at some kind of starter fishery, so to speak, where you can, receive a certification to start out in a small boat within 3 miles of shore fishing for handline fish. And work the way up from there instead of going, full blown, which is what we've got right now. So maybe we need some kind of scale up so that young people can work at, independent harvesting on their own to see if they like that first before having to go all the way. And maybe that's what you want to do is just handline fish. I mean, that's all I'm aiming to do as I work through the leveling up process at PFHCB. But so there needs to be really serious discussions about how to address the problem, because we do have a problem. So, and that's apparent because it's there. So what do we do to solve it? The other thing to look at too is that when you're talking about career development, you need to start before the age of 9. There's research to indicate, and I know this from being a former teacher, that children's ideas about what they want to be when they grow up start at a very early age. And so the farmers have a handle on this, and they've got things like agriculture in the classroom, little green thumbs, they've got community gardens, and they've got gardens in classrooms, and they've started addressing this for farming. But we're not doing anything for fishing. So we really need to start getting children interested very early on. And what's the best way to get people interested in fishing? It's to promote fish as food. And so to get fish into the classrooms as a food, to get fish, to get children out fishing, to get them into boats and to expose them to it. The advantage to teaching children fishing as early as we can is that there is so many more advantages than just getting professional fish harvesters. There's that mental health component we were talking about earlier. There's that connection to heritage. There's so many other careers that you could get interested in by getting in a boat and going fishing. I mean, Newfoundland, as we all have talked about, is an island. We could be the gateway to the Arctic, or we literally are right here. So we should be getting children into boats as soon as possible so that they can be, once again, what Churchill called the best small boatsmen in the world. So when, previous to World War II, we had children growing up with their butts in the punt of the boat. We have now more children who have got their butts in a recliner playing video games than in a boat. We're talking about ocean technology. 2021 starts the decade of ocean science. So let's get our kids back outside near the water and in boats. And let's really be that nation that's the gateway to the Arctic.
As you were talking, I was thinking in terms of how often have I caught myself, don't go out on the wharf, you're going to fall off and hurt yourself, when one time that's where most of the youngsters used to congregate to watch the boats come
rats.
In and yeah, wharf rats for sure. We seem to be wanting to protect ourselves from those experiences. How much do you learn just looking over the edge of a wharf?
Oh my. Yeah. So we've become this risk averse, litigious, worried kind of society. And we've really done our children a disservice. We're afraid to let them climb a tree because they could fall and hurt themselves. We are afraid to let them go out on pans of ice because they could fall and hurt themselves. But yet, we'll, when they're 16 or 17, we'll give them the keys to a car and expect that they're going to handle, you know, a $40,000 vehicle that can go, I don't know, 100K, and expect that they're going to handle that risky kind of thing in an appropriate way. Like, let's let children handle risk at earlier ages, leveling it up appropriate for their age, so that when they are old enough to drive a car, they're used to evaluating risk and know how to mitigate it and manage it, instead of us protecting them in their entire lives so that when they're teenagers, they can't manage it. There is a huge amount of pride and, you know, and sense of accomplishment that comes from mitigating your own risk. And that's really, you know, that one of the things that we do when young people participate in programs with us is that we have wooden boats and they repair the wooden boats. And then the next week they get in the wooden boats. And sometimes they look a little worried because these are boats that they just repaired themselves. But can you imagine the feeling of accomplishment you get when you're out on the water and your wooden boat doesn't sink? You know, it's just something that we all don't think of very often, that we don't get to experience that level of accomplishment. So we're not giving our kids enough.
We have fewer teachers, too, really, in many ways. And I'm not talking about professional teachers. I'm talking about people who teach you the skills of life.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
our families are much smaller nowadays. A lot of people have one, two, or no children. So there's fewer children now growing up who are going to have cousins, who are going to have aunts and uncles, who are going to have older siblings or younger siblings that they can either teach or learn from. So, you know, when I was talking about the kids going out on the wharf, I was thinking in terms of, if I was the mother of eight children, say, for instance, I would not be so focused on my child being on the wharf. I would be thinking about it and worried about it, but I would, in my own self, be thinking, well, her sister's with her, or, you know, whatever the case may be, as opposed to watching and waiting and don't you, you know, that kind of thing. So is it part and parcel of, you know, like the structure of our families these days, the fact that they're smaller and we tend to obsess a little bit more over one individual?
Oh, exactly. I mean, that's part of the problem. Our societies have changed now. I mean, I remember as a kid growing up in Grand Falls, before I got home from school that day, my mother had already received a phone call and a report on what I had done. So we don't have those networks anymore. And so that's why it's important that we develop these programs with these targeted, with this targeted programming. So that's why organizations like Fishing for Success are really important, because we have volunteers who serve as the elders. You know, like you said, going down to the wharf as a kid, when you and I grew up, we could be those wharf rats. And we knew that the people at the wharf, at the community wharf, were keeping an eye on us. And so now we can't do that. The wharfs are commercial places of work, and you can't go there. And so how do we duplicate that same environment that you and I could experience as kids? So we need to develop organizations with targeting programming like Fishing for Success, where there are volunteers or trained teachers that have this outdoor programming for children. It's really needed.
My guest today on Target is Kimberly Orange. She's with Fishing for Success. We'll be back right after this. And we're back. My guest today is Kimberly Orange. She's with Fishing for Success. And have we as a society ignored or turned away from fishing?
That's a big question. Wow. I think we think of fishing in two ways. This commercial thing, and we've just sort of, it seems like we've just been happy to let multinational global corporations take it over. And then we've got this recreational thing going on. And so we seem to just kind of let those two things happen. And neither of those are healthy ways to view fishing. And I think, it's a big problem, because there's so many other deeper, richer ways to incorporate fish and fishing into our lives that we've kind of been discussing during this last 45 minutes or so. And so I think as a society, yes, we've kind of ignored how fishing can contribute to a richer life personally for each of us. And exactly. I never thought of it that way.
Is the future of the fishing industry, are women the future of the fishing industry in Newfoundland and Labrador?
I think it is. I think we've got to get there. We've got to get in it. And we've really got to fight our way into it. We talk about STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And oh my God, there's so few women there. And we've got to fight to get women into STEM. So we have targeted programming and we have coding for girls and all of these things to get more girls and women into it. And because we can't let any career avenue for young women be overturned, but yet we're ignoring fishing. About 20% of registered fish harvesters are women in Newfoundland and Labrador, and less than 2% of fishing enterprises are owned by women. I think that's a huge cry for us to do something there and tackle that industry. We can't let our heritage industry just fall to the wayside like that. So it's definitely a call to bring equity to our traditional industry.
I may be ending the show now on a controversial note.
Uh-oh.
but what are your thoughts on the food fishery?
Well, the food fishery, I'm so glad you use the phrase food fishery because, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans calls it the recreational ground fish fishery. And because Fishing for Success was established to teach children, we cannot call it the recreational ground fish fishery. Because when you go fishing, you kill a fish. And we can't teach children that it's a recreation to kill a fish. It's a food fishery. We are killing this animal for food. We're grateful for the life of this animal, and we're going to take this animal home to feed our family. And it's a gift from the earth that's feeding our family. So we can't use the term recreational. It's insulting to the fish. It's insulting to our human connection to the food chain, to this whole web of life, to nature. And so we can't use that term recreational. It's wrong. Fishing is something that humans have done since they could waddle down to the ocean and collect protein from the shore. And we can't call it recreational.
No, it is insulting when you think about it that, we're not going out there for a lark. We're going out there to get something to eat, really.
I mean, it is kind of a lark. It's very satisfying to bring food home to your family. I mean, how many of us in this modern day get to do that anymore? You know, that's one of the best gifts that you can give someone is to feed them, is to provide food for them. But again, it isn't a lark. When you examine your family's budget, what's the first thing you take away when you have less money to deal with? You take away your recreational things, going to the movies or what are some other recreational things that we would delete from our family's budget when our money is short, right? But as far as fishing, that's, in my opinion, that's something that I wouldn't delete because that's, getting out in nature, that's getting food, that's connecting to heritage, that, getting that nature therapy that you need, that extra physical and mental health boost that we all need. And so it's too important to call it recreational. It needs to be called food fishery and just leave it there because there's so much ceremony connected to food. The first thing that we do as humans when we have a funeral or a wedding or some other very deep celebration or ceremony is we share food together. And that's what we're doing when we go fishing.
Kimberly Oren, I feel like we could do another show or two on this. And at one point I will invite you back, but we have to leave it there now. We're soon going to our live COVID update for today, which is coming up at 2:00. But I appreciate your commentary this afternoon. We'll do this again.
Absolutely. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you. Thanks to our listeners as well. And our guest tomorrow will be another petty harborite. Is that the term? Alan Doyle is out with a new book, All Together Now, which is something you've often heard Alan Doyle say. So he's going to be our guest tomorrow on Target St. John. Stay tuned for that as well. Thanks for listening.